Welcome back to Core Ideas, the podcast interested in all things related to lake sediments and paleolimnology. My name is Adam Jaziorski, and as always, I'm here with my good friend, Josh Steenpont.
Good evening. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. It's been a while since we...
We always say that, and it's been an even longer while.
Yeah, it's the time is growing. Although fall grant season is busy, and so it was unavoidable.
It is. Scholarship applications, things we've been talking about. It actually fits quite nicely into the last couple of episodes of this arc. But for those who either are new to the show, which seems unlikely, or more likely haven't heard us in a few months, weeks, remind the good people out there what we're talking about and why our recent preoccupations have kept us from the podcast.
Yeah, we don't just talk the talk, we walk the walk. And in today's episode, number 54, for those keeping count, we continue the money, money, money arc with another look at research finances. This time, from the perspective of the university, the institution itself. So in the past, we looked at it from the student perspective. Last time, we looked at it from the individual professor or research lab perspective. Now we're scaling it up to the institution level. We're definitely not experts in this area, but are, you know, done a little research on the side, just looking at some annual reports and trying to look at the various funding streams that, you know, come into and finance the elite institutions of this world.
Exactly. I think, I'm not sure if it's accurate to say no professor or student or person like that is an expert in these things. I'm sure there are people who either have a predilection for these kind of things. They like, they're interested in finances and maybe it's tied to their research. But I learned a lot thinking about thinking about this episode and what goes into running a university, how big they are, how much money we're talking about, what the different streams are. I just didn't really think that much about it, really, which is kind of funny considering it is an overarching thing about your everyday activities. So,
yeah, but I agree in the same way. I think it was less. There wasn't much in the way of revelations, but it was just, oh, you know, I never thought about that, or, and you know, they're just there in many ways. It's like you don't need to know how a TV works to watch TV, and yeah. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of depth beneath the surface, and then, I guess, you know, even a smaller institution like Queen's has a lot of individual research labs. And there's a lot of cogs in the machine, and the machines can get quite large.
Yeah, and you start as an undergraduate in this system. You know, you get onto the ladder, and you climb up the different rungs of the ladder. We don't really think about the ladder itself. Like, it's just always a feature of the space that you're in, and not that much about who pays to fix it.
So I guess the place to start this conversation is first, you know, we kind of, so the ladder is always there, but we still need to define what we mean by university.
Yep. And college. Maybe we'll get into that, I guess, because it is sort of part of this system, right? We can think about that a little bit. What is the definition of a university?
Well, I guess there's lots of different ones. And I think one that really jumped out at me when we were looking this up, and who was it by? Shelby Foote has a quote of, a university is just a group of buildings gathered around a library.
Historically, that makes sense. You know, imagine the paintings of the great libraries of all of the old university institutions, Oxford, Cambridge, your universities in Italy. Like some of the ancient universities there. What you're probably going to see in a picture of those, if you Google that institution, is their library, is looking down through the stacks of the books. Didn't I see a thing that one of the libraries is the image for the Jedi Temple in the remake of the Star Wars? Like, they got sued because they just copied a photo of I think it's Oxford's library.
Really? This is news to me.
Yeah, I maybe it's just something I saw on Instagram that was complete bull, but you know, the idea is sound, right? It's this housing of knowledge. It's this vessel to store all of this information.
But interestingly, the library as the centerpiece of the university is probably an idea that is now diminishing. Mm-hmm. And as especially in the era of the PDF and online resources. So maybe a more practical definition rather than a romantic one would be an institution of higher learning that grants degrees. I think that's pretty fair.
For sure. Yeah. And it obviously is a Latin origin word, right?
I looked it up.
You did? Oh, my goodness.
Prepared. Fluent in Latin?
You are.
Not really.
Great.
No, no. But the word university itself is derived from the Latin phrase universitas, magistrorum, and scholarium, which roughly means a community of teachers and scholars.
Oh, so there you go. So that's interesting.
And so I
that's
think
about
that
people.
Like
that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's people focused rather than building focused or knowledge focused, which is kind of interesting that is where the root phrase comes from. And the first universities in Europe were established by the Catholic Church or monks of the Catholic Church. And the first University of Bologna in Italy was founded in 1088. So got institutions dating back
almost 1,000 years. Like they conceivably, you know, I'll be a little over 100 years old if I make it that long when they celebrate their 1,000th anniversary of the university. That's crazy. No, obviously no Canadian institutions or North American institutions are of that vintage. But there are a lot of them. If you think of Canada and spread across the country, the distribution is certainly not equal. Most of them are clustered into Ontario, Southern Quebec. But there are a lot of different degree granting university institutions. I think 81 is the number.
I think 81 is the official count.
Yep. Of public universities. And there are some private institutions out there that aren't included in that have different mandates. And they, you know, that number has been pretty constant for a relatively long period of time since the huge boom in new universities were formed in the 60s, 70s. But it does increase. Like there are new ones that come up. UConn University.
I was going to name them as well. I think they're still the newest. On the list with like 2 years, 3 years?
Two or three, yeah. Though there is talk about the other territories getting their own universities in comparison to the colleges that they currently have. And that's something that maybe isn't that important of a distinction for this kind of discussion, because a lot of the things about the financing of a college, as we call them here in Canada, is probably not that dissimilar from what we're going to talk about, even if the focus is less on research than it is on vocational kind of teaching. But in Canada, at least, there is a distinction between colleges and universities that may not be the same in other locations. It's actually not the same in other locations. In Canada, colleges tend to have diploma granting as opposed to degrees, and focus more, not exclusively, but more on kind of skills-based learning, shorter duration programs than four-year degrees, honors degrees, centered around a huge range of different technical aspects. Where I think in the States, though, that's not the case, right? A college is just any university that doesn't grant a PhD or doesn't have like graduate level program. So, you know, Americans would say they're going off to college when what they mean is they're going to get a degree just at a university that doesn't give out graduate degrees, doesn't have grad programs.
And very much the focus is research, because we're talking about research funding. So we've got the historical view of universities, again, almost 1,000 years, 81 of them in Canada. I recently found out, and I think this is a kind of neat little fact to add as well in terms of like the age thing. So yes, we have no 1,000-year-old universities, within Canada, but Queen's University, its charter predates Canada actually, by like 15, 20 years, I believe.
Yeah. It might be even more than that.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm just, I recently discovered that and thought it was kind of neat. But in, outside of that view, maybe taking a more cynical look at the degree-granting institution, every university is essentially a business with roughly the same mission. They're in the business of knowledge, and they want to bring in more students and build more buildings and grow and do more research and bring in more students.
And bring in more students than the competitors, like it's a competitive business too.
Yeah, they're competing for the same resource in many ways. Multiple of the same resources. They're competing for students. They're competing for professors. They're competing for research dollars. And how do they do that? Where do they get their funding? And basically, it comes down to three major funding streams. There would be the tuition that the students pay individually as a fee to go to attend the school. So we're, again, have a Canadian bias to everything we say. So provincial and federal funding. So basically public sector funding, government funding. And then also, you know, I guess private funding, endowments would be another big funding stream. This is particularly notable, again, coming from Queens. Just in the last couple of weeks, there has been a very large endowment that made it into like the national news of the engineering faculty has received $100 million.
That's real Smith money.
Engineering has big, big money, which makes me question, like, where are all the possible billionaire benefactors willing to put their names on paleolimnology buildings?
I tell you, I don't know.
They're still waiting.
You can reach us at Core Ideas Podcast. if you're so inclined and you want to support in that sort of framework, but no, it's jokes aside, that's huge money, right?
That's huge.
That's from a single individual person,
as opposed to,
you know, all of the money that all of the alumni would contribute to through smaller donations, like pales in comparison to those large gifts.
And this is the second gift, because his previous gift of $50 million went to the business school.
Right. We said this very generous goal. I mean, that's a huge amount, obviously has a great tie to Queens. But he now has, what, a third of the organizational units named after him, if you include business and engineering now?
Yeah, of the faculties, yeah, because we have arts and science, education, law, and health.
Okay.
Four to go.
Yeah. He's got four to go. Yeah. If he's probably has enough to do it. Yeah. Anyway, good for him. But yeah, so those are pretty very different, right? Like endowments are you can't guarantee that those things are coming. You can't bank on someone rolling up with the truck of $100 million to buy off and it's not buying those things. I'm just kidding, you know. But to provide that amount of funding to whatever it needs to be done, whereas tuition, you know, is set by the university within some parameters, some of them that they can very directly control, others are totally out of their control. And the government funding from the provinces or the federal government or whatever analogous there is in other locations is an interesting one, because that some of that is tied to students, right? It's tied to how many students are being brought in. And then there are other programs and research related funds and overhead and all of those kind of things that come in from other sources. So that is a mixed bag on its own. So huge range of different places that the money comes in.
And they're also, and so I kind of came into this thinking, those are the fairly obvious ones that most people have heard of. You know, they're no real curveballs coming there. Tuition, public funding, individual endowments. Another one I did not realize how big a chunk of the pie it was is the investment portfolios of the universities themselves. And because I guess, you know, that $100 million gets added to the existing pot, because it's not all going to be spent on one day. And there's going to be some element of investing it and then you know, using the returns on those investments to fund things. And then kind of tied into that would be things like patent portfolios as well and licensing arrangements. Is like, so there's some non-obvious, I guess, income streams as well coming to these very large institutions.
Yeah, as you said, they're businesses. They're big businesses. That's a lot of money. And so as you would need to have a healthy, large business, you do need a broad portfolio of income sources, some of which, you know, you can control very tightly, some of which are like in the investment portfolio. Their investment portfolios must be just so diverse in so many different types of investments, some of them being higher risk, some of them being very easily liquidated in the occurrence that, you know, you need to build this new building or whatever. You don't want to take penalties on all those things. The number of people it must take just to manage that aspect of it, or, you know, to, you pay an external company to manage those things, just speaks to how complicated the operation of these big institutions is.
Yeah. And so I think we thought it'd be kind of fun to dive into some of the publicly released reports, kind of break down some of these numbers. And we looked at both of our home institutions, York and Queens, as potentially illustrative examples. Then we found out that the Queens financial statements were a little easier for non-accountants to read.
Yeah, it's all there. Like, you know, these are public institutions, right?
So public institutions, publicly reported.
Anybody documents. Can go and find these documents. It's just the Queens one was just the high level summaries were just a little bit easier before they dove really deep into the minutiae of the spreadsheets and the nice line graphs. Items. So we'll go through Queens as an example, though you could imagine this applies to any.
And just scale up or down depending on like the relative size. So like Queens is a member of the U15, so the 15 research intensive universities within Canada, or most research intensive, I guess, is like an organization. All of the U15, they're the smallest, or at least one of the smallest, if not the smallest. But they still are a very large business by any measure. They, according to Wikipedia's numbers, which were a mix of like 2022 to 2020-ish kind of numbers, have approximately 4,000 academic staff and another academic staff, 3,000 administrative staff.
Of which Adam is one.
Of which I would be one of those, less than 3,000. And then a total staff of about 10,000 people. And that would include everyone. At that point, you're getting to
custodial staff, physical plant, to, yeah, everybody. Probably food service operators, although that may be
That might external. Be outsourced yeah, in some
depends
level,
on
yeah.
the location. But either way, everybody who comes and clocks in on Queen's campus.
So about 10,000 staff in total. And about 34,000 students in total.
Including undergraduates.
Undergrads, well, yep. But about 26,000 undergraduates and just under 6,000 graduate students.
Postgraduates, and then probably that includes the professional programs like the MBAs and those kind of things. Yep.
All right. So you have, yeah.
So it's a lot. That's like 45,000 people kind of kicking around a fairly small area compared to some universities in a given time period. A few of them, you know, maybe overseas at the castle. Not anymore. Sorry.
No, they're on the way back.
But on the two campuses, you know.
Yeah. And so we're able to find the Queen's 2021-2022 financial statements online. They're probably a year newer is available somewhere, but you'd have to do a bit more digging than we did. But the headline numbers that came from that budget was a total revenue in the 2021-2022 fiscal year of $1 billion. So we're in the B's.
Nice round numbers too, which is quite helpful for comparison.
Of which I was kind of surprised to see that only $400 million came in from student fees.
Yeah, only. I mean, that's a big number.
Less than half. It is a big number, but less than half.
But less than half, yeah. There is, you know, the students coming are not the main source of funding for the university.
And furthermore, less than half of annual revenue in a, well, was a quite a bad year for investments. So one of the key sentences in the executive summary was, in 2021-2022, the university completed the year with a deficit of $3.3 million, driven primarily by weak investment returns, mitigated by careful management of expenditures. So the 2022 investment income chunk of the pie was a mere $23 million, whereas 1 year prior, it was $258 million. So in a good year, the tuition would be down around like a third of total revenue.
Yep. Yeah, that's a noticeable, well, that's a noticeable change in a single year, and shows just how volatile certain cash flow components of the gross income revenue, whatever you want to call it, are in a given year. And yeah, the tuition part is fairly fixed, right? They're not vastly changing the number of students coming in. They're not really changing tuition at all at the moment because there's a freeze in Ontario. So that's sort of a baseline amount, and the huge swings that can go from a pretty nice surplus in the year before to a fairly small deficit, $3 million is almost nothing kind of in the comparison, are totally driven by market fluctuations.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, so the, I guess the tuition aspect of it all would be like load funding, I guess, or like baseline. What, how do we do when we talk about nuclear power, like baseline load versus, because yeah, you don't see swings of tenfold differences year to year in, student enrollment. But anyway, so I found that quite shocking because I realized that, you know, yes, there has to be some money going on in terms of like these endowments and being set aside for capital projects and this, that, and the other, and everything's slow. And some of the endowments are probably have restrictions on how much of them can be spent in order to provide a revenue stream for the university and things like that. But was shocked by how big a slice of the pie it wasn't even in a bad year.
Mm-hmm. So those are the main kind of statistics at the biggest level. And so if what else do we need to think about in this picture? We have sort of the main inflows.
And this is very much for one university, but we imagine it scales fairly closely to others in terms of, you know, like some things will differ a bit. So somewhere like York, the ratio of undergraduate students to graduate students will change, and differences of professional programs and things like that. But they'll have like maybe double the students. And so
something like that. Yeah.
But and, most and, things will scale.
And some more stochastic things. So right now there's a lot going on at York, thinking about the need to bring the deficits that we're running under kind of control a little bit. I think they're in more like the $30 or $40 million deficit range for the last little bit.
Well, I think Queens as well has had a much worse year in the.
But some of that's based on just bad timing, right? Like, so there's capital projects that they're just finishing building the Markham campus for York University, which is $100 million kind of output that originally was to be funded at least in part by the provincial government in Ontario, and then they said no. After it had already been all approved, and the university is like, well, I guess we still got to do this. So they had to dip into the, you know, into the investments to pay that thing off. And at the same time as market changes, COVID, all those kind of snowballing sort of problems. So there are some kind of things that are just impossible to predict in those values. But you're right. Whether you go to Algoma or UBC or Dal or whatever, you're talking about the same milieu of sources of money coming into the university and going out as well.
Yeah. And it's the same general mix. And I guess kind of really emphasizes what the universities have direct control over. They don't have direct control over the return on their investment income. Yes, on some level they do, but market forces are the main thing driving those. You can't massively change enrollment in year to year. Yes, you can do a steady increase of capacity in allotting spaces to grow your campus and your potential student enrollment. But really, the big one that I guess that the university has much more control over is the public sector funding, specifically the subsets of that which they're competing for in terms of research grants. Because a student, the provincial and federal contribution per student is going to be fairly universal. But the amount of research dollars a particular professor brings in will vary tremendously based on particular research program and the research priorities of the university and the type of professors that they are hiring, what their, strategic goals and priorities are in terms of how they're allocating the capital side of the equation, what facilities they're building to bring in which professors, which will affect the, which is going to be their marquee programs in many ways.
Yep. And we're talking about the whole university in all of these kind of figures, but subdivisions of the university, the faculties, the schools, however you subdivide them, have their own budget, obviously, that needs to contribute. There are have departments and faculties, and there are have not departments and faculties. And there's some ways in which the balance of those things work. Primarily, though, at least at York, that's a size scaling issue. The big faculties have money and the small faculties have less, because it is driven by tuition in those cases. But it's also they have more faculty, which means they have more they have more research input. So it's quite hard to be a small fish in the pond of some big fishes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I see this in the day-to-day in terms of departments and faculties of who collectively has enough money, which of the departments that have enough money to fund a specific research administrator yep. for the department versus not. And the difference between having someone to offload administrative tasks to versus not having someone to offload administrative tasks to is a big difference, but there's a definite cutoff in terms of how big does the unit have to be in order to be able to pay someone full time.
Absolutely. And you have those couple of, those stem from having those few researchers who bring together a group and bring in $15 million over 3 years and all of the associated fees that come into the faculty as a result of the department and the faculty associated with that as a result of that research output. So you're right that those can be massive differences across the board and really things that can be controlled. And that just means the unit, whatever it is, whether it's the whole university, whether it's the faculty department, whatever, can do more with it. Because, really, what do you need to do? You need to keep the lights on at the university. You need to pay all of those 10,000 staff members. You need to maintain the buildings. Hopefully you get to build a few new ones. Although those aren't always together. A lot of times money goes to building new shiny things and not fixing the old and busted things. But eventually you have to pay those debts on maintenance and renewal. And that's pretty much it, right? You need to deliver programs. So it's fairly straightforward what the out part is, if you think about a university.
Yeah, you need students to keep coming, and then you have the whole, how can you grow in terms of the growth of the universities is limited by the growth of Canada in terms of their immediate kind of student pool, and that has led in recent years to a greater reliance on international students and international fees. was another avenue for growth that had a curveball thrown at it by COVID, and there's like a bit of knock-on effects going on.
COVID, absolutely. Visa issues associated with that and travel, but other things too, like crazy geopolitical things. The news of Canada officially sanctioning India because of the alleged assassination of a Canadian national by Indian security in British Columbia. Like that happened just a couple months ago, and India is the number one source, at least at York, of international students. So if it becomes harder for those students to travel to Canada, already difficult in the given world, then that impacts the bottom dollar a lot.
Yeah, and potentially very quick changes in an area that normally doesn't change very quickly. But when visas just immediately stop being processed, it's like the difference between yesterday and today can be massive.
Yeah. During COVID, we had graduate students who just could not get visas and they had to delay their beginning of a program. Like that knocks onto the faculty members' research, what we talked about last time. It's just
same thing happened to faculty members. We had new hires that were hired, you know, in the run up and were trying to move to start up their lab. Unfortunately, during peak lockdown, COVID lockdown, and just the doors are slammed shut.
Tons of different things.
So, you know, as it's very apparent that we are not experts in the realm of university finances. Even those experts can run into problems at times, as was brutally illustrated in February 2021. When in Sudbury, Canada, Laurentian University, out of the blue, filed for creditor protection and basically...
Shocking.
Failed overnight.
Failed, in terms, yeah. A university.
Billion-dollar enterprise. I don't know, you know, they would be a bit smaller, but several hundreds of million dollars of annual revenue easily.
Probably quite a bit smaller if you think about how just Queens hits above its weight, probably money-wise, in terms of students. York... probably is pretty average, but is very big. But yeah, irregardless, like that's a crazy, like it was shocking.
Yeah.
Just, you don't think they came
out of
fail.
Nowhere.
Yeah. I mean, it probably didn't come out of nowhere if you were like really paying attention there. But it didn't make any news outside of, or it never made it to my world.
Until it showed up online, the morning news.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if this is a good example of things that go bad and the problems that could be, because like it just seems like every story you hear about it is just one further insane revelation about what was going on in this place. But it is a cautionary tale for sure.
Caution tale on several levels. One, and I guess part of it is like the books are being misrepresented on some level. Because, you know, publicly, they had 8 of the previous 9 years that had balanced budgets. So everything was all hunky-dory until it wasn't.
What happened in that 9th year?
Well, I don't think the 9th year was the one.
Okay. All right, then something's a little screwy.
I think they had
on
one
those.
Deficit year. You know, the budget was balanced until, like, yep, no, things have been misrepresented and... international, or is in COVID in February 2021, and I guess the House of Cards came toppling down in some regard. And in hindsight, I think it may have been unnecessary, like, or some of the reports after the fact that, you know,
jumped the gun a little bit on
the creditor protection aspect of things. They should have gone at that. With theoretical options to talk to the problems beforehand, who knows? But that's like the big news story of university finances that I can ever remember.
Oh yeah, and hopefully it remains that way. Like, we don't want universities failing. There are lots of reasons why that's bad. There are many employees who are out of work and had to find other things. There are many students whose programs just, whoop, you can't finish this program, doesn't exist anymore. We don't have any faculty to teach in it. There were not that many students. including the like Northern a few of the few of the French language programs that are just not offered in other locations. Like those are real life altering for not the chartered accountant who ran that place or the university president or any of the academic staff, like for the students who thought they were just going there to get their degree, you know, in this program they were interested in. So,
and even on a bigger scale, like life altering for people of that region writ large, in terms of, you know, the whole one of the main pulls of Laurentian is like gateway, you know, university at the gateway to the north, you know, that had a real focus on educating people of the north so they didn't have to necessarily travel to the Yorks and Torontos
for sure, or collect from more northern locations. Yeah, like it can't, you know, northern Ontario is so vast. Sudbury is arguably a northern Ontario, but like it collects
gateway to the north. That's the city motto, isn't it? Yeah, it's like,
yeah, because where are you going to go next? Sault Ste. Marie, Algoma's tiny, Nipissing is no different, and then Lakehead is a heck of a long way away, so yeah. For sure. So it's an interesting example. I think there's probably still little bits to come out of that story, even though if it has faded from the regular discussion day to day. But yeah.
Okay, it'll have to come out at some point because Laurentian has restructured. It's continuing in a diminished form.
Yeah, they didn't close. There's still a university there.
Yeah. But, you know, there was a financial earthquake and everything changed overnight for a lot of people.
Just another example that they're big corporations. You know, there's lots of things going on there. York is in the billions of dollars, you know, a couple billion dollar kind of annual budget, and in a period of seems like a bit of growth with this new campus at least, which is meant to reached, you know, the goal of that is to reach into a different area and have students who want to remain in Markham, for example, but take very different programs from what our Keele campus or our Glendon campus provide. But that's a gamble, putting that much money into a university building, but campus that the nearest university that they're competing with is York University, right? like why would they not go to main campus, to Keele campus? I guess maybe Scarborough is closer, but close. Maybe they're competing with Scarborough. Maybe that's the goal.
And it's probably very, very close.
Yeah, exactly. But you do need to think about that kind of diversification and the programs and what students want. And that's the other thing that I find is interesting is that a lot of the kind of programming it changes quite a bit, like what people are interested in, where, which programs are going to be popular and bring in tuition. And it changes with the news, with the interests of just population. Complicated.
Learn a code.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of those kind of technical kind of aspects at plan for Markham and meant to be very urban and all those things. We'll see. It's supposed to open next year. So,
I guess I don't think we have too many more things to wrap up. It's just very interesting in terms of, again, the universities being big corporations with many, many things outside of the university's control in terms of the various pieces of the pie. And I think one that comes up periodically in the news, quite often in relation to York, actually, is
labor.
Union contracts, labor contracts, labor, and things coming to a head in a period of rapid inflation and contracts not keeping up with the cost of living, which we talked about in reference to students in particular, but affects everybody on some level. And then, you know, at least provincially is more complicated by there being a freeze on public sector contracts over the past few years, or not a total free, like I guess a 1% limit in a period of where inflation is running several times that, and things come to a head.
They do, and they will, especially as the judgment has been that piece of legislation was not legal or in good faith. I don't sure what the legal terminology is, but it's basically been struck down. So for those of you not familiar, in Ontario, there has been this provincial legislation that public sector salaries couldn't increase by more than 1% per annum for, I don't know, what, like the last 5 years, something like that?
I don't know if it's a full 5 years, but most of the current term.
Yeah. And that has meant that even if you're negotiating a new collective agreement, which obviously happens usually on 3 year cycles, that there was no salary increases beyond that. And however, that's been struck down. So there's a big push at a lot of institutions to retroactively negotiate salary increases over those time periods. And some of that are done within the bounds of new collective agreements. So like at York, our faculty is in the process of starting the next collective bargaining cycle and will be in part of that. And others, it's just ad hoc and being done in addition. And that might be important for some unions, but others that may not be as critical as some other aspects of negotiating. There's often 4 or 5 different unions operating on a university campus, representing their members and their members only, obviously, trying to get the best deal and conditions for them, whatever those priorities are for that group. So as a university, like negotiating with them is an enormous job. One thing we did want to make a note of, it's actually with reference to a podcast from 2 episodes ago, but has come to my attention. Perhaps this was already the case when we recorded that episode, and we just didn't think about it. But when we were talking about scholarships, fellowships and scholarships for graduate students and postdoctoral fellows, we were talking about all the different examples that there are. And one of the ones we referred to are the postdocs for Northern Research, postdocs in scholarships for Northern Research that the Weston Foundation provides and is generous enough to support and has for many years, back to when I was a postdoc for sure. And I think they started fairly late in my grad career. But they're even more generous now. The amount has at some point recently gone up. So the master's level award remains the same. And the doctoral awards,
which was, throw a number there.
Oh, 20,000 for the master's. And the doctoral awards are now 120,000 over 3 years, or 40,000 a year. And I don't remember what they were before. They may have been the same. They may have been 20 grand. I'm not sure if they doubled them or not. Anyway, that's pretty good. And the postdocs, which were 40,000, are now 55,000 up to 2 years. So pretty significant increases there in as a percentage, which is awesome. So big round of applause to the Weston. There's been a lot of discussion, as we talked about, regarding the need to increase those, because many awards far older than this fellowship and scholarship program haven't increased in decades. And you know, this is more in line with what it really takes to train high quality personnel. So good job.
Absolutely.
Anything in the mailbag this week?
Give me once checking to rustle around in it. No, we have no mail once again, but that's all right. Okay. That's okay.
That's all right.
If you do want to send us mail, please go ahead. But again, thanks again for listening to Core Ideas, the Paleolimnology podcast. If you have a question or a comment, or perhaps a suggestion for a future show.
Yeah, we only have, I think, 1 episode left in this arc, so we're taking ideas.
The clock is ticking, folks.
Sometime in March will be.
Sooner than that. We have it mapped out already.
Yeah.
Please send us a note.
All right. And you can do so by sending us an email to coreideaspodcast@gmail.com, or the Mastodon handle is @coreideaspaleo@mastodon.social.
That's correct.
We abandoned Twitter. But But you can still find kind of an archive, I guess, there at Core Ideas Paleo. And maybe we check in from time to time, but not actively. We read everything you send us eventually.
An archive of our past episodes and show notes is maintained on our website at
coreideas.ajazurski.ca.
And the easiest way to find that link, rather than spell it out, is to pull up our Mastodon bio.
And if you're so inclined, you can give us a rating, you can subscribe, leave us a comment. We'd love those on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you consume your favorite podcasts. Those 5-star ratings are great. But to be honest, we don't get many and we don't care all that much because we're just doing this for fun.
We're pair nerds. And that's it for today. But we'll be back soon to explore how money fuels academic research in more detail, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy, even when talking about the economy of knowledge.